getting into syncretism and mysticism, I was able to see how maybe I could just encode my songs symbolically with something that played into a larger purpose that, you know, that I was pursuing, which makes it not very approachable, I think, to a wider audience, because it's so, you know, vague and dreamy in that way. I mean, but maybe some people like that, I don't know. At some point, you can't worry about it, like what people are gonna, how they're gonna take it.
This is the Beware Hal Show, mystic philosophy made practical. I'm Bob, speaking weekly with Scott and Ryan. We're three conscious creatives and formerly closeted mystics trying to unpack the inaccessible. According to the mystics, the truth cannot be spoken, but we'll try to talk about it anyway.
Today we have Shane Renfro of RF Shannon. He was born in the Texas Panhandle, raised in the Pines of East Texas. This stark contrast of scenery would eventually come to inform the minimalist brand of hazy pastoral music that he and the band creates. I love this whole bio, and I would like to read more of it, if that's all right with you, Shane.
Sure.
Your music began in 2014 as an experiment in psychomagic with the intention of healing ancestral gaps. As R.F. Shannon is the name Renfro would see on pieces of mail as a child addressed to his late grandfather. This became an enduring expression of unique songwriting. Quoting Shane, "I think we carry a lot of ghosts, individually and collectively, from a lack of connecting with the process of living and dying well. I think our individualistic tendencies have unintentionally orphaned us in some way. In our songs, I'm drawn to calling up oniric images, symbols, unknown things, and wrapping them gently in a tapestry of my musical influences, namely country and old soul music." So cool. I love this last part here, which is genres and like the blurring of genres. I've never really cared to figure it out. I like the idea of a Southwestern sound. That's my haunt. We're too country for the indie world, not country enough for the Americana crowd. Too mellow for the psych scene, too Texas thunderstorm for the California sunshine. Shane, as R.F. Shannon, has released 3 full-length albums in 3 years. 2017 was Jaguar Palace, Trickster Blues in 2018, and 2019's Rain on Dust, out on Keeled Scales. Shane, thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me.
So glad to have you. We know each other through Will Patterson, who is a talented songwriter, musician, recordist, Foley artist.
It's true, yeah.
Product developer. He's a busy person. And
he's a savant.
He is a savant. And he recorded Rain on Dust. And started amazing playing bass album. With you guys.
I've been playing it all week. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you so much. Trickster too. He did Trickster Blues also.
Did he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been obsessed for a while now, but I'm glad to have introduced your music to these guys.
Thank you.
So yeah, I have a pretty loose agenda. I mean, Shane, you have a, you know, contemplative, you know, I would say mystical, if I may, although that word is difficult for some people to unravel. I think it matches a lot of the creative work you're doing. So we'll get into all of that. But I think just first, give us some more about your background, personal, professional, how you wound up doing, making these great records.
Sure, I'll give it a go. You kind of hit on it already with the where I was born and raised and all that. I don't know. I think it's all kind of fraught with this tension of feeling that music, at least the way that I considered the scene to be, felt pretty meaningless And it still does to me in a way. So there's always this tension of when I moved to Austin when I was 20 and I was in school, and I remember sitting in class, and I've always sort of had issues with authority and academia in general. Not like on an epistemological level, just, you know, I guess I hated the order and the rigidity of it. And I remember walking out of class and thinking, man, it'd be so much more beneficial if I just learned how to grow food, you know? So that happened when I was 20. And so I quit school and embarked on a journey that eventually led me that summer to Montana, where I learned permaculture. And, but it's hard. It's a, I can't ever find, like, I don't really have the makeup, it seems, to just jump into a totally isolated rural farming life that I romanticized at that age, you know? So back to the city it was. And I quit playing music, basically, because I did play music up until the time I was 20. I lived in Nashville briefly and gave that whole thing a go. But like I said, it just felt like it wasn't really a necessary thing to kind of bring change and healing to the world. So I quit for a while and started dabbling in all these things, but definitely felt this missing chunk because I wasn't contributing artistically, or, you know, all this stuff's began to build up inside of me. And I think by that time I had gotten it more into,
well, I'd been introduced to a book, The Secret Teachings of All Ages. I don't know if y'all have heard of that book by Manly P. Hall.
Yeah. That's a great kind of jump into the quicksand.
Well, that's sort of what brought it all together for me. Like I said, there was this tension and this sort of alienated, you know, I was compartmentalizing all these things and judging them based on some value system that wasn't really cohesive. But once I got into that book and I started understanding like syncretism, I began to see how music could play into
a more holistic like approach to like everything I'm doing could be valuable in that sense, you know, and they could reinforce each other rather than feeling guilty that pursuing music was just this vain, self-absorbed like situation, you know.
Very important realization to not be too dismissive of something that has the power to be more transformative.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of it comes from insecurity as well, because lyrics have always been difficult for me. Like in my 20s, I was just so into just the Texas songwriters, you know, like Towns and Guy. And I was like, I can't do that. I don't sound like them. For some reason, I just felt this urgency inside me that was like, I can't just tell these stories again. You know, I can't, or make up stories. Like I can't really do narrative, you know, lyrics, songwriting.
They're fantastic at it. And I think that's a true genius they had was, and I think that with songs or poetry where it's, you can say the most with the least, you know. And I just never figured out how to do it. So from studying, getting into syncretism and mysticism, I was able to see how maybe I could just encode my songs symbolically with something that played into a larger purpose that, you know, that I was pursuing, which makes it not very approachable, I think, to a wider audience, because it's so, you know, vague and dreamy in that way. But maybe some people like that. I don't know. At some point, you can't worry about it, like what people are gonna, how they're gonna take it.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's less approachable. We've talked about in the past how your vocal track is almost another instrument. It's very like a complementary kind of a fuller sound, and there are some singers that dominate the track and should dominate it. You know, I'll brag on my colleague collaborator here who has a beautiful damn gospel voice, and he's working on some brilliant stuff now. But
is that who I heard earlier today?
Yeah, this is Scott.
Really beautiful, man.
Thank you. Yeah, no, but your sound though, I've been enjoying it all week. It's like for a person like me, it's very approachable because it's right up my alley as far as the the dreamlike qualities of it. That's kind of, you know, that's usually what I'm looking for within when it comes to like the sound and the lyrics. So that,
right on.
That definitely resonated with me. And I feel like I'm seeing it more often. It's, I don't know. I can't tell what's relatable to who these days, but you're right. It's like, that's kind of, you lose the point if you're trying to chase that down and, you know, you can kind of focus on whatever feels good as it's coming out of you.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely important for you to make that realization that you're not Towns, you're not Guy, you're not writing the next Poncho and Lefty, you know, that's its own genre or time period, or like emulation of that is ultimately not sincere, right? If you have,
absolutely,
you got to tell it from your own perspective, your own lens.
Yeah, I feel like if you try to stand on the shoulders of giants, you lose your chance to connect with the earth and the time and place that you're there, you know.
Yeah.
And it's cool that you, well, I know that we've mentioned about how using my voice as almost like another instrument. And I think that's something that's interested me is I tend to do very rhythmic, fricative, phonetic, like John Lennon does it, like on Walrus, you know, I'm the Walrus. We say, it's just like very punchy,
right,
with these things. And it to me reminds me almost of like seed syllables in like Sanskrit or in Tibetan, you know, where you are using these punctuated noises to push out air to sort of correspond with whatever that feeling may be. So
sure, to generate an emotional resonance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And I don't understand music theory at all, but I've always placed kind of more importance on almost transcending like the meaning of a word by how the sound will fit into the rhythm. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I don't know to what end. I don't know what that accomplishes, but it feels almost primal in a way, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's allowed me to bypass this like deconstructing, like this lyric sucks, like this doesn't work. I'm a shitty poet, you know? It's like, I don't know, just work with.
There's such an unhealthy amount of that though.
Yeah, for sure. But I don't know, I guess that briefly in a nutshell gets me from the tension of wanting to like, you know, idealistically live on a piece of land and grow food with what's valuable to the world. And then music, like fighting that could be valuable. And then just saying, screw it. Maybe these are actually like sound spells to try to, you know what I mean? Just the intentions there, the chanting is almost that, you know, in a way, and just kind of playing with that as a model of kind of, I don't know, hopefully some beneficial magic, but there's not like spell.
It's not very like, warlocky. I mean, not blatant, but
And I'm not sitting there like, this is the intention. This is the working of this song.
Right.
It's just kind of a passing thought. It is this hodgepodge of like syncretic, like vomit that's coming out of me. We'll call it a healing purge though. Not to be gross.
But it's intuitive. I mean, I think the intuitive quality comes out and, you know, your work, I think as a whole, to me, it is very like, I mean, shamanistic in essence. I mean, it's very like connected to the land. It gets across the frontier. It gets across, you know, the weather, the video for Black Madonna, So Divine of Jaguar or Trickster. Which one was that? One of the earlier records.
Trickster, yeah,
so cool. This video is this lapse of, you know, nature photography, and it really perfectly syncs up with you know, a lot of the imagery that you're getting across
with
your sound. So I think it's great work, man.
Melissa Cha did that video. She's fantastic.
The sound definitely transports you to that space, which is one of my favorite things that music can do, is bring you, especially if it's a space you've been near before. And so it creates almost like a memory effect. And it's really, really powerful.
Yes.
Feeling.
I appreciate that observation. We're all for the most part, we're very rudimentary musicians. And so instead of just trying to like reference our, you know, people that we really like or it is just about creating a very basic, kind of like if you think of the elements or the directions, just like north, south, east, and west, if you can orient yourself to that and anchor yourself within that, you can create a container where there's an experience or, you know, and that's all I try to do with like the bass, the drums, the guitar, using them almost like in that simplistic way of like, that's just the container. And it just kind of moves softly through that with the voice at the middle kind of being the intent. So that's how I see it, which is not, that's why it's so hard to like hang out with like other band people or musicians, is because I'm not really a gearhead. I'm not really, yeah. I don't listen to music all the time. I just, it's just kind of another aspect of like moving through the world magically to me. And so that's why it's hard to get like any kind of traction to in the music world, because it's like, I don't really want to play those rules, you know, play by those rules. And
mm-hmm. I think that's an important role that you're playing. I also appreciated your disclaimer qualifier about Will, because he is certainly certainly sophisticated, technically, like frustratingly so, where he'll be like drunk at 2 or 3 a.m. and like perfectly playing some ragtime, like like it's just like infuriating how good he is.
Ragtime, is that what you said?
Yeah. Just
with like, some baroque,
right? Yeah, just it doesn't matter, whatever it is, he could just effortlessly do it. But no, to the point of, you know, it's funny that you kind of see it and can communicate about what you're doing in a way that is more philosophical. And I think that might be what you're alluding to as far as like difficulty within the music biz of like marketing and you know, now producers are looking at data to see like what, you know, Spotify tracks that are being listened to, and like, and I know this is the same way with shows on Netflix. Like there's currently like statisticians that are reading when people drop off shows, and so I'm sure that's when people drop off songs, and like how do we aggregate this data and like make trends out of what people are enjoying and how much and etc. and it seems to really neglect a lot of the process that you're talking about, in that it is more primal and you're communicating this like fuller truth.
It does, but I'm trying to harness, and let me know if I get too, this gets too off the rails, but I've really been trying to understand lately how, you know, you're speaking of algorithms, and I've been trying to, rather than turning my back on it, because I really am not interested in that kind of data, but from the consumer perspective, you know, but I am interested in it. And from a probabilistic perspective of, are you familiar? Have you guys heard of rando nodding by chance?
Mm-mm. Mm-mm. Nope.
It's a new thing the kids are doing. it's fascinating to me. It is. There's an app called Randonautica, which I recently got, and what it is it's based on a quantum random number generator. And what it's hoping to explore is intention driven anomalies or mind matter interactions. So like for instance, the Global Consciousness Project, which I think started out of Princeton, middle 20th century, set up random number generators all over the world, which are constantly, you know, computing just random bits of data, right, and numbers. And then they found over time that when large scale global events would occur, like 9/11, the 2004 tsunami, COVID even, they start to find that these numbers start syncing up into a pattern, like a discernible pattern. So it raises the question, like what does our consciousness, how does it affect, like is it an instrument in probability, you know? Anyways, so now rando nodding is this app where you have an intention and then you get a random set of coordinates within a given radius, right? So I can, for instance, I did one the other day that was, I just thought of the word or the image of blue star. I study, or I'm influenced by like druidry and druidism, and that's like an old, it's in the poems of like Taliesin, and it's just an old kind of construct that they use. Anyway, so I've had a lot of synchronicities with Blue Star before, so I put it in, and it takes me to this location, and seemingly it's just in the middle of nowhere. There's a field. I'm looking around, and I'm just like, nothing seems to really be connecting with me. And then I look down about 3 feet behind me, and it's just an old Bud Light can that has the blue star, like the blue, like, you know, emblem. And obviously it's like, what a goofy thing, but it is a meaningful coincidence, right? Or is it a coincidence? Yeah. So it's like,
love it.
Of all the places I go 5 miles away, I see nothing else around me. And then just look down and I see the blue star, you know? And, cause it was a can, it was like an older one.
I love it.
Anyway, just goofy, but I'm interested in how songs maybe could act as.
But that's also your personality too, a little bit, is that you're also on that level of like inanity alongside of the mystical, like, you know, like it hits on both layers by being a beer can and like kind of jokey, like.
Right. Well, and that's it. It's like, if we're dealing with it, so that, I know this maybe seems like I'm out in left field here, but we're talking about, I kind of jumped off on this based on like the algorithms and how that's obviously from a consumer's perspective. And as trying to be a working musician, it's very difficult. It raises a lot of issues and frankly turns me off from the whole thing. When I started understanding how I might be able to engage through, if I'm dealing with quantum random number generators that are popping off in a university in Australia, you know, and then algorithms are using this same, if we're getting to like formal world, you know, like in a platonic sense, like the same source, I'm interested to see how I could start playing with music and songs as like, and like these intentions as like timestamps to sort of anchor some deeper way of performing, playing, writing music that is almost like injecting this kind of more subtle energy into the algorithm itself, you know?
Beautiful. No, super compelling. I mean,
experimental.
I love it. You're very right on as far as like, at least the three of us, we're still getting a handle on who the hell our listener is. But, you know, we did a whole episode on, for example, consciousness as fundamental to the universe as opposed to matter. And you and I have talked about this kind of stuff also at quantum physicists.
Observer effect.
Have maintained, like the there's not this vacuum of kind of distant meat suit, disconnected matter, you know, like that is a level. But I mean, they tell high school kids that atoms are mostly empty space. Like this, it started to permeate the education system, even how flimsy matter is. So right. Yeah, I mean, this guy in particular, Mark Gober, wrote a book called An End to Upside Down Thinking, which we kind of did a book review of, really, which kind of looked at all these different anomalies across a variety of disciplines. And, you know, mainstream science, right? Mainstream science is rejective and actually political. I mean, there's political elements to why this kind of stuff doesn't get surfaced. The human ego is involved. But ultimately, I mean, I think the pioneers of, and the Dean Radins of, who we talked about too, the Ion's chief scientist, he's written 3 books. One of his latest books is called Real Magic, where consciousness is connected. Yeah.
Is he studied NDEs a lot, right?
I think so. NDEs are in that book, An End to Upside Down Thinking.
I just remember loving hearing his reference to Gober said, mentions that Carl Sagan even mentioned that like the random number generator thing is worth looking into, because he said that was one of the areas where they got statistics that you can't explain away by chance. And even Carl Sagan was like, we need to look into the apparent ability of people to affect random number generators just by thinking about them, which is like, sounds absurd to the average person, but
yes.
A like devoted, you know, scientist communicator put that in his book, that like he couldn't explain it away, which I thought was fascinating.
Super cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for mentioning that. I think there is a quality that you can absorb and try to, like, you, I think you use the word inject, you know, or contribute to in a way that is cohesive with the general, either the general populace or maybe the communities that are, you know,
it's interesting,
right, for your information.
It's interesting to apply that idea to music and like the consumption of music on a global scale. 'Cause it really, you know, as with everything now, it's all being you know, run by servers, like these massive, you know, programs and algorithms in the back end, but those are still all being impacted by daily human activity. So like what is the interplay there? Like what's in control? Right. How do you influence it? Is it all just like a locked in formula where you're only going to get shown, you know, to people who you want? It's just, there's a lot of questions there.
That's the thing that interests me most about it, is I think it's potentially revolutionary to, if you can wrap your head around it and just walk through the door and try to understand the implications of what we're talking about, it to me fights despair, because I often feel like this technocratic machine is just sweeping in, and there's a sense of nostalgia and soul nostalgia where it's like I feel homesick on Earth in my home, because this like force is just moving through and it just seems unstoppable, impenetrable, just, you know. And that's natural to feel like anxiety about that, because as things change, everyone's always feeling anxious, probably unconsciously. But to start to maybe think that you could fight fire with fire by engaging in this like kind of work, by understanding that non-locality and like being able to collapse this perceived separation we have from all this power, these algorithms, these things that are so out of our control, you know, maybe we could start affecting things. It's a revolutionary act, I think, to maybe take this information and see it as though it's incumbent upon you to have responsibility to engage with it in a non-consumerist way, you know?
Yeah,
hugely important realization to have. I think it's something that, yeah.
I also don't know what the hell I'm talking about, but I, you know, it just it feels right intuitively. It's like there might be something to that.
Well, there's a huge misconception to me about sciences that, you know, we're kind of like there's this like, what's the word I'm looking for? Like prideful kind of scientific materialist banner of like, absolutely, you know,
the myth of progress.
We're just atoms randomly, and like there's no significance whatsoever. And thankfully, science has enlightened us to show us how meaningless we are. And like, it's such a frustrating misread. Like Terence McKenna, who I'm sure will be coming up in throughout the course of the show and future episodes, but you know, his whole thing was we're the culmination, we're not the, you know, it's a complete redirection. Like we think we're so insignificant. No, we're actually consciousness's, you know, peakest evolution of, you know, take the power back, realize, you know, your own true nature and your own true potential through that awareness. So right there with you, man.
We're the cutting edge of reality experiencing itself, yes, you know?
Yes.
Absolutely. Like, and that's a revolutionary thought. Like if you can really realize that, yeah. It's because then you can start to take some responsibility for that, you know? And because otherwise it's just consume. And I know I bring up that word a lot. I've been thinking a lot about it lately, but, no, absolutely.
Talk to us about your creative process. Go ahead, Scott. I was just going to keep going
into rabbit holes of human knowledge and the nature of reality. But
well,
that's,
we can come back.
There
we can
lies
come back.
Madness.
I just,
so let's,
I was
let's
feeling moderatory.
No, please. No, I want to hear more about
perfect,
Shane
perfect
stuff.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, tell us. I mean, you. It's to me, in my understanding of people making good records, it takes a lot of time, and you have put out 3 in 3 years. I mean, that's super impressive, man. And they're really fantastic pieces of work. So, you know, what's the secret? How do you start it? What's the collaboration aspect?
Man, I've really been thinking a lot about that lately, because I have been pretty deeply kind of frustrated and insecure about the process that has led to those 3 albums. They happened really fast, and I'm almost embarrassed by how quickly they happened. But it was largely informed by resources. I didn't have, I knew I don't have the money to like go and spend months or weeks even in like a fancy studio, which we tried to do at Jaguar Palace, but we didn't know what the hell we were doing. Like, to be completely honest, when we first began, when I started writing songs, our first EP is called Hunting Songs because I was hunting for songs, for a sound. I was just like, I don't know. Like, this sounds cool. This sounds cool. I'm glad it's not widely available now. Then we go to Jaguar Palace, which was, okay, let's do a real album. And the idea was that it would be a double LP, and just like, I was hiding a lot behind, you know, notions of this very subdued psychedelia and like lots of reverb, because I'm just like, still don't know what I'm doing, you know? But that took a year to do that one. And I'm not terribly happy with the way it sounds. I don't mean to sound all like Meg, but then we get the Trickster Blues, where like Jesse Woods and I go out to Marfa and like rent a place for the summer. And he starts helping me realize kind of the more run and gun Neil Young way, where it's just like, don't let, you know, good enough be the enemy of perfect, and just like,
beautiful,
sounds good, the vibe's there, let's go. So he turned me on to just not overthinking everything, and that's when things started happening quickly, because we did that, and then we recorded it in 3 days here in Lockhart with Will. And so Jesse was kind of my secret weapon on that one, by helping me shift my approach. And then Rain on Dust was largely written when I was living in Los Angeles, and the songs came very hard fought, and it took a while because I didn't really have a lot of personal space and time to like write songs. But I guess the process is something that I'm renegotiating with myself right now, because I usually kind of have to get into a trance or ecstasy state via substances to, it's not good in a lot. That's not going to work in the long run, but yeah, like, not, don't worry anyone, it's not that bad, but it's just like, just
I was for usually a second. Just like, I'm glad you clarified.
Just usually just like a six pack of beer and weed, you know, yeah, that kind of thing. But then it's like, well, if I want to do this every day,
yeah,
you know, for my, I can't do that every day, you know? And I can't get to that level of, you know, oniric by just waking up and doodling, you know, I have to kind of give myself over to some like state, you know, which is, you know, that's something that I am already having to reshape from that sort of tragic songwriter guy that you like, you know, the town's archetype or whatever, where it's just like, you know, they're fucked up, but man, they're brilliant. Like, and it's like, when you're young, you're like, cool. But now it's like, that's not okay. Like,
right.
I don't want to be that moving forward.
It's like cartoonishly like, it's like, yeah, it's a caricature now almost of like, yeah, strung out,
yeah,
genius.
Exactly. And I've definitely got my boundaries. Like, I really don't mess with the darker stuff, but still, like, I'm just trying to tweak. Like, at this point, having gotten more into meditation, and I really like to give something truly more healing rather than just like random magical doses of whatever vibe I'm injecting. Like, I don't know. So now I'm trying to find a new way. I don't know yet the new process. I kind of try to do
meditations. Like, I get a little stone and then just do some meditations and then just see what comes out. But I'm definitely not a technical songwriter. Like, I don't sit down and like, do, this is the structure and this will be, it's just like, I'll play, and if something just starts happening that sounds good and resonates with my, you know, the crickets in my, something in my stomach, then I'm like, there's something there. Mm-hmm. I'll do a quick voice memo of it, and I won't push it. I'm not going to sit down and be like, I'm going to write this song tonight. Mm-hmm. It's just like, that's cool. And usually the more I try to consciously shape it and work on it, it's like doing pottery. You touch it too much and it gets nasty, you know? So I let it be, and I'll come back to it maybe the next day or maybe in a week, and just bit by bit pick it up. And then in a month, it's like, through trial and error, there's a working song, you know? Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's kind of a sad and way to do it in a way. Never really like fully enraptured by the song until you hear it recorded. You know, it's not like some moment of inspiration that's like, I just got to communicate this.
Yeah, it's really beautiful hearing you talk about that kind of shift in your process. I mean, I think that's really, really cool, and I'm really excited to see how that, you know, maybe shifts in future work for you. But I think just being aware of that and being willing to take a look and shift, you know, shift and being willing to do that, I think is really great. So I think
there's a contemplative quality that you're seeing the, you know, I mean, pretty damn good fruits off the lesser methodology. But, you know, yeah, may you find that even fuller experiential creative process that, you know, more thoroughly gets across what you're doing.
Sure, I hope so.
I think everyone can resonate with that process too, yeah. Shane. I mean, I think it's very, very normal process for a lot of musicians that I've known and met anyways. And even for myself too, I mean, I'm more of a visual artist, but I play music a little bit, and, absolutely, you know, smoking a little bit, and it allows me to get into this space that I know I can tap into, but, you know, maybe if I smoke, it'll help me get there a little bit easier, a little bit faster, and things start to just flow a little bit better. But I'm always battling that of like, not like, how do I do this without that? You know, like, how do I tap into this space without that? And it's a constant work in progress. And I think it's really cool.
Absolutely. It helps me sometimes to view, like, if I am going to partake in like some weed and some wine or beer, to see it almost sacramentally, like, because I'm not a stoner, so I'm not like just ripped all the time all day. It's just like, if I'm intentionally like, I know that you remove resistance from me, you know, and kind of help me jump into the pool of like the felt presence of immediate experience, to go quote Terrence McKenna, oh Terry, you know, it feels kind of good. So I, you know, it's just finding a balance. And because for me, one of my biggest challenges is I tend to have, I've spoken of that cognitive dissonance and that tension of just kind of feeling shame for like needing to use that. And it's like, well, the shame's not serving me either. And I don't know. So it's just kind of just jumping in and just being willing to see the creative process as also a creative, changing, fluid process, and playing with that. And, you know, it's evolving, I'm evolving. It's okay to just kind of be gentle on myself. And I don't know. So we'll see how it goes.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well said. I think the shame component,
I love what,
is a blocker.
Yeah. I was going to say, I love what you said about removing resistances, because that's exactly what it is. And that's a part of my spiritual practice, is that is the work, you know, is removing resistances to kind of be fully yourself, trying to find kind of my inner child. Like, that's where I find the most just like beautiful expression of creativity and freedom and playfulness and joy. So it is like, it is a total process of removing the resistances, right? And it's great that, you know, I think we all resonate with that, like how, you know, that process of removing those resistances, yeah. But
sure.
Yeah.
And I feel that really it's just, they're training wheels, but like they're helping, as long as we realize like it's within us already. We get to the point where we don't need the training wheels anymore, but, be grateful for absolutely any help I got along the way. So.
Totally. I was just going to say, I'm the only non-musician here, but, essentially what I'll do is when I'm editing a film, I will make a sequence, you know, rationally, logically, et cetera. And then cannabis helps in like later edits to reveal the rhythm and the tone and the, you know, less kind of on paper aspects to the cut. It's almost like it's embarrassingly like overt, like it's abrupt how, you know, how did I sequence this, you know, this way before, you know, realizing this part needs to play on a little bit further and settle into the viewer and generate more emotional quality before I get into the next point of concept and so on.
Yeah. I could give you some perspective like that. And to your other point about how you felt a little guilty about how long you wait between like writing sessions or, you know, you start a song and then you set it down for a while. I've kind of learned that that's really an integral part of the process. Like it's really important because that time gap gives you perspective and it lets you get out of the mind you were in when you wrote it so that you can like approach it from more of a producer's angle and like kind of finish it and put it together and all that. And in a way, like weed kind of speeds up that process for you because it'll send you off into space and it's as if you waited 2 weeks and came back to the song or the cut or whatever.
True. That's a good point. It is good to like let it simmer. For sure.
How far in are you on the next record?
I've got a lot of tunes cooking, like good. Music. Just
I'm sure you do.
Working on lyrics, but just basically started. I've had 3 rehearsals now with my brother and my friend Johnny jumped in on bass just to hear them finally played. Like, what does it sound like with the bass and drums in there? And, you know, so very fresh now, but very cool, like very excited. I think the energy is kind of picking up because obviously with COVID and everything, like forever, like, you know, 6 months since I've played music with other people. So, it is picking up. So I'm
shout out to your brother, Jeff Renfro, by the way, who's a killer Western drummer.
Shout out Jeffy. so yeah, it's just kicking off, but, I think we're in it now, you know?
That's great. Good. So for I'd say maybe
we're 5% there.
Well, the last time I asked you was like, when Rain on Dust was coming out or before, and I was like, I'm really liking Trickster Blues. And you were like, yeah, the other one's done. I was like, oh my God. So anyway, you got quick turnarounds, but yeah, this is a time for contemplation and productivity. And you know, you're holed up. Are you in Lockhart? Are you back in outside?
Yeah. I live in Lockhart.
Outside of town. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Are you implementing any permaculture, you know, for anyone not familiar with Lockhart, Texas, which might be people listening to this, that is about an hour outside of Austin, which is a large city. And Lockhart-Wimberley area is, it's small. And it's also, you guys are kind of being, there's more artists and creatives that are migrating to
Yeah, I'm very excited about that. I actually see this kind of being a trend that is maybe going to grow as we are reassessing so many things in light of the last 6 months.
Yeah.
Where, you know, I think it's important to be able to foster little pockets of resilience be it with food, like communities, like growing food and artists, like not being able to play shows and venues probably shutting down. It's like we're really having to renegotiate how we're going to do this. And it's nice to be in a smaller, more manageable place where I feel that we can probably more quickly realize where we want this to go. You know, I think in Austin, it's a little harder. It still is happening. But to answer your permaculture question, I have with some friends, 10 acres just outside of Lockhart. And it's been a long game, man. It's been a very tough, a lot of hardship. It's, you need money, it turns out, to do that stuff. And we were young technology. And dumb, but yeah, we're about to get electricity out there, which is sort of, we view as an appropriate technology to be able to start making that shift to, you know, I'd like to have a house, small casita built out there in 3 years or so. But yeah, just trying to do some soil building and address water systems and do permaculture, large scale permaculture planning, zoning and such. So that's happening on paper right now and just trying to go out there and maintain it.
But let the land do its thing at this point. It's been telling its story and telling cattle to get the hell off of me for a while. Let me regenerate.
So it's just been kind of this waiting time of, you know, saving money, learning. Hopefully when I cross the threshold of 40, it'll be moving out there and shaking. So it's a long-term process, but I'm definitely thinking about it daily.
These guys are both green thumbs.
Yeah?
Oh, I wouldn't say that. I'd say...
Well, then I've misread you for years.
I grew up around my mom, who was one, and she taught me all she could, but... You know, I just didn't, I would love to. It's like, it's one of those things where I'm like, one day I'm going to be as good as my mom is at this stuff. But I have not made that yet.
Yeah.
It's Ryan then.
Yeah. Maybe, yeah, in years past, I gardened for a couple of years and it was a lot of fun. I learned a lot. I haven't been gardening for the last couple of years. It's mostly just house plants. But
you're also doing
actually like permaculture is something I'm super fascinated in.
Vinegar. What are you fermenting? Doing? You're doing some fermentation. Thank you.
Oh, fermentation.
I don't know.
Homesteading.
Yeah,
of some kind.
I do a lot of fermentation. Vegetables and.
That's wonderful. That's such an important part of gardening that I learned is a lot of people when they start their first garden, if they do a good job, they're super shocked at like. How much you need to harvest the food or how much food there is in general. And it's like, what the hell do I do with all this? Like now that I'm sick of eating carrots or I'm sick of this. It's like learning to ferment and can't, you know, preserve your food is an equally important part that certainly we're having to relearn as we got away from that.
Yeah. But, the reaping the harvest.
Yeah. And what to do with it. Yeah.
I want to get an orchard. That's what I want. I want like a few peach trees and just water the trees. You know, it feels like there's less work and more reward. Maybe I'll just become a peach magnate of East Austin. I don't know. But
does everyone in your little community just eat barbecue? Because that's all, like, to me, Lockhart was like where we stopped on the way from my house to my grandma's house in Victoria, Texas. And we stopped there to eat barbecue in Lockhart. That's like all I know.
Sure, it's definitely the main draw. But during the last 3 years or so, the square has become very vibrant and more diverse with food options. So yeah, tons of people still come out for barbecue, but there's a great pizza shop called Lupin Lil's that has like good craft beer. There's Little Trouble, which is associated with Justine's in Austin. There's Commerce, which is foreign and domestic people from like getting some pretty fancy little things out here little town.
That's great.
So luckily it's for me now, it's like not just barbecue because
we went to a coffee shop that was walkable to where you guys lived. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I helped open that coffee shop.
Oh, nice. Wow. Yeah. He was a musician. The guy in there that Will was like, oh yeah, this guy is a drummer or something.
No, it's great that little Texas town is getting some diversity and some new blood in it.
Yeah, definitely. I feel very lucky to be here during this time.
Yeah.
Well, what else? As we round to the hour plus, we kind of have a new formula for the ending of the final section, I guess, is favorite books, favorite thinkers, which is a pretty long list for you, I know. But, you know, maybe someone that the way I would kind of like to phrase it is like who slept on. That you think more people should know about, or you know, who's more obscure than they ought to be in your experience that you're a fan of?
That's a good question.
You're currently saying how obscure do you want to go on the show? I know.
Well, I don't necessarily know that Alejandro Jodorowsky is obscure to a lot of people, but. Because of his films, he's more known in that context, but his book, and he, you know, coined the phrase psychomagic, but the book Psychomagic definitely shifted my perspective about 6 or 7 years ago on many things, and especially how art ties into all the healing work we're trying to do on a deeper level or going into mysticism and any such direction as that. And his tarot book, The Way of Tarot is fantastic. completely different angle. I encourage anyone who ever is going to try to study tarot to go.
Great rec. Holy Mountain.
What's that? Yeah, absolutely. Alejandro Jodorowsky is an important thinker to me. Stephen Jenkinson. I don't know if you've ever heard of this cat. He has this notion of orphan wisdom that I've really been working with a lot lately, but his latest book, Come of Age, The Case for Elderhood in a Time of Trouble, is very, I would recommend people check that out. Martine
Tell Krechtel. Us more.
Tell us more authors or more about?
More about that one. I mean, the show is called Beware How. Ram Dass is a huge influence on me and all of us. And he spent, I mean, basically the 80s and 90s lecturing about old age and aging and death and, you know, and then dies in 2019. I mean, the last 30, 40 years of his kind of spiritual teaching career was about that very topic and about the kind of misplaced Western values on generational, you know, to us, because we're technology culture, everything, they're irrelevant. You know, it's like now it's the boomer thing, but okay, boomer, but also even older than that, right. You know, it's like the greatest generation, right, or whatever, can't use a cell phone. And so, and like, actually they've lived through decades of Maya. And like, let's maybe ask them some cues and learn some things, and you know, they have a role to play in transferring wisdom and transferring understanding that they've gained that we tend to disregard.
Sure. So, especially, I think it's an important concept to explore dealing with like your own whiteness right now in this time where it's.
Oh yeah.
I think it's important that we decolonize our minds. And it's in order to do that, orphan wisdom kind of offers this insight that understanding that at some point we also were colonized, like in terms of like my ancestry or whatnot is pretty much straight up ancient Celtic. Blah. And it's like trying to understand that rather than appropriating other cultures, although I am really into like syncretic like ways of understanding the patterns that are, you know, that are in indigenous healing traditions of all kinds, but like trying to dive more deeply into mine and realize that orphan wisdom is the notion that, you know, the colonizers here were also at one point colonized, and like what was our connection to the land at one point pre being colonized, and going back through that and trying to understand and kind of grieve that, decolonizing your mind so that you can be on the earth now as a force of good with the end of oppression, the fight that we're all in right now, you know? So
beautiful.
That notion of orphan wisdom is realizing that we've all sort of been orphaned from our original lands that we were, you know, at one point in good relationship with.
What was the force that disrupted that? Was it patriarchal Iron Age, you know, early civilization, you know, barbarianizing people? I mean, I guess that's...
Yeah, I mean, essentially, in that specific case, it's just the age of empires, you know? It's right. the Roman Empire going in and systematically, you know, taking that culture away and calling them pagans, you know?
Sure. Also, the ancient Celtic, that it all makes sense now.
What do you mean?
Just a bardic 2020, you know, it's makes perfect sense.
I'm very, very interested. I try to learn. I've been reading the Mabinogion, which is like the earliest British prose from, you know, which is essentially the Welsh Bible, if you will, of like that time. But it's very hard to suss out the sort of popular culture versions of like the Arthurian tales and just kind of the BS. And like, if you want to listen to Celtic music, it's just going to be this Shire, like, you know, like, you're like, what was it,
river
really
dance.
You know, river dance, like, which is pretty badass in some ways.
I'm not trying to hate on river dance, I'm just saying that's the
pop culture. No, but you're right, it's hard because it's just like everything, it's, you know, our culture has just become neatly packaged as this like nostalgic
shamrock
post-historical little meme that you can shoot, you know, like
There's real depth though under that, you know. Yeah, that's super important.
That old culture.
I'd like to understand that. So I've been.
I was hearing about in Ireland, there's still laws on the books about fairies. Like, that's how seriously the older generation still takes them. Like, if there's like a bush that needs to be cleared, or like a tree that needs to be cleared for like a thoroughfare, and if like the local elders say that fairies live in those trees or bushes, it is against the law to cut down the trees or bushes. Like, that's how intense they are.
You kind of cut out when you, are you, who are you referring to? Iceland?
Oh, no, sorry. Ireland. I heard that.
Ireland. Okay. Yeah. Iceland is like that too. Oh, Iceland really? Still has fairy houses and, or, you know, things set up that are, they, roads have to go around it. You know, it's very, and that kind of ties into, the elderhood thing, which is, I think a lot of our sense of total disregard. And don't get me wrong, like, man, we've inherited a lot of shitty situations, you know, from shitty decisions that have been made for a very long time. But placelessness, I think, is very, very much contributes to this lack of grounding in terms of like understanding lineage and why that would, we have no container or context as to why our elders, what even a true elder is anymore. Like, now it's just okay, boomer, blah, 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 you know. And a lot of that sentiment, I understand, is warranted from, but that's all in a materialist capitalist model that we're having that relationship with elders where it's just like, yeah, okay, boomer, you know. I would like to get outside of this, you know, materialist model that is, that's what's shaping our lack of relationship with that, I think, at least partially.
No, it's so true. Yeah. Yeah. There, I can't remember the name of the scholar, but they're talking about culture and how the word culture is in agriculture and horticulture. It's in the, it's
permaculture
tied to the land. Yeah, exactly. Like the very word itself semantically lives in, you know, the society through the ground that we stand on. And, you know, yeah, you're right. There's been a lot of migration.
Yeah, what does that mean, you know, for a population that left their land and then stole other people's land and then formed on top of it? Like, what does that mean for us? And it's not good. That's all I know. Like
collective psychology. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And awareness, I think, to Shane's point, awareness of that collectively, historically, is kind of step one, you know, to unwinding and unraveling the, you know, healing the wounds.
Shane, I'm curious, how much of your kind of the reading that you do informs your lyrical writing?
A fair amount. Like Orphan Wisdom, for instance, like I don't use the words Orphan Wisdom, but I will ruminate on that notion. And like on my last album, the song Ballad of a Thin Place is very much about the things that we have just been talking about. So having read that book, it definitely opens up this door of exploring the implications of like what the kind of suffering or the wounds that need healing right now, you know? And so, you know, I talk about placelessness, and like the song Ballad of a Thin Place is very much about placelessness and our inability to really see place, because it's usually in the context of, in this specific song, the context of just seeing it as an accessory to your social media presence, you know, or like just obviously the way Instagram took it, like places are just so you can take a selfie and
backdrop.
Show that you're there, backdrop, you know. But, you know, so there's this perspective in that song of the land itself seeing you passing through it versus you watching it through your, you know, so it's just kind of this grieving that the land is having, you know. That's why it's called a ballad, even though it's not a slow song, but it's just a relationship that needs to be healed with between person and place. So it affects a lot.
I'm glad we got to lyrics, because I wanted to, I feel like I just jumped in early there, but I wanted to mention one of my favorite lines, which is Kali Yuga, call it California. which is like when I was like, wow, I need to like befriend this person closer. Because that, I mean, the record's terrific, but there's little, and maybe also kind of back to the point earlier of like the fact that it is complimentary and like the lyrics aren't necessarily emphasized, you know, they're just like, did you catch it? You know, it's re-listen candy kind of thing where you notice it later. And I already liked the melody of the song and I had already gotten the way it goes, but I found that line, you know, five or six listens later, and that's an interesting quality to kind of tuck
you
in.
You just made my
gems.
Day.
Yeah. Beautiful. Perfect.
You made my day, because I really do. It's little nuggets where if you get like the play on words, and like if you know what the Kali Yuga is, and you know, obviously everyone knows the archetype of like California decadence.
Plasticity, and yeah, exactly.
You know, it's that's it. You know, it says it. So it's cool to hear that. Yeah, you might pick up that little breadcrumb while listening to it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, man. Mm-hmm. Success.
What does your writing process look like? Is it, are you kind of writing just to write and some of it becomes songs, or do you specifically sit down to write lyrics for songs, and like how often are you doing that? Is it like a daily
practice?
It's all
the above. I often write music first, and that's when I'm with my weed and my all, you know, I'm just like vibing on something. Lyrics don't really come out at that point. I don't really have a writing practice. I'm very, very bad at it, but I try to at least daily or at least every other day, just kind of stream of conscious, just write things. And then sometimes throughout the day, I'll just think of a passing phrase in my head that I'll write down. So it's very scattered, you know, just planting little seeds for myself that later in a different state of mind, I'll come across, oh, that's cool. And, you know, I'll just pull that. So it ends up kind of being like, and sometimes I'll intentionally take all the different, whether it's in my, you know, my journal or the notes on my phone, or sometimes just some random pieces of paper, and kind of do a cut up like William S. Burroughs style of mixing and matching, and, or like set them up like a trigram from the I Ching. Just randomly start putting words together and seeing if I can get some kind of communication or some coherence from just that randomness, you know?
Divination.
So it's very, all over the place, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, there's a technique called morning pages that's interesting that I've been experimenting with and surprised myself a couple of times on, if you're not familiar with it, listeners or you guys, but yeah, it's a technique. It's Julia Cameron is the name. She wrote, it's called The Artist's Way, I think is the name of the book, but it's, you write three pages on handwritten in the morning, front to back, and you have no prompt, and you just start writing, automatic writing also, I guess it's called, but she has very strict rules, like it has to be within 40 minutes of waking up, because there's this brain shift that occurs at like the 41st minute after you're awake, where you're not in that kind of dreamy, receptive quality. And anyway, I think it has strengthened my writing, since starting it. And there's a couple of gems that you see in there. And, you know, I don't know, there's a process to making, there's something to value of, the rigor, I think, kind of in the dailiness of it. Like, I'm all about the like existential kind of when it comes aspect also, and like not forcing it necessarily, but you know, it does feel useful to be consciously you know, trying to do it as, in a framework, a certain period of time, or at least in that morning time when you're really receptive to information from wherever it comes.
I'll have to try it.
Yeah. Well, Shane, thank you so much, man. I really enjoyed our talks, and I think it's quite clear that we could get lost in a variety of other wormholes. But perhaps we'll pause for now and come on back and join us in the future.
Yeah.
Yeah, give us an update.
I'd love to. I won't let y'all down again.
Perfect.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for having me, guys. And thanks, it's nice to meet you. You guys.
Yeah, thanks too, man.
See you soon.
Thanks so much. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Looking forward to the next record.
As well.
Bye, buddy.
See y'all.
Bye.